GoDaddy.com. Use the code BLU139 to get 10% off any combination of purchases at GoDaddy.com. See site for details. Get your piece of the internet at GoDaddy.com. Tango Tango Papa 1334, May 9, 2010.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Covington, Tennessee. I didn't record a podcast last night, but I spent the night last night at White Pine, Tennessee, on my way to drop and hook at Covington, Tennessee. So I made it to Covington. Guess it was either late this afternoon, it was still daylight, late this afternoon, early this evening, however you want to look at it. Made it there, did the drop and hook, and as invariably happens, once I left the place, they sent a load offer, and it picks up at the same place, and it has two drops. It delivers, I think the first one is in Monday and up in Illinois somewhere. Then the second one, I believe the load ends in Iowa. And so in the meantime, the guard there said, well, there's a truck stop. You just turn, you go up to the main road and you turn right, and it's a couple of miles up there on the right. Well, I never did find it. And so in the meantime, I came, I don't know, 2 or 3 miles or 4 miles, and there's this rest area. And so I just pulled into the rest area, and I decided I'd just hang out right here. And then whenever my break's over tomorrow, Sunday, I will simply go back and go back to the warehouse and do the drop and hook with the loaded trailer, and be on my way to Illinois. I think it's... What'd she say? The dispatcher, I actually called them up because it had two drops, so I needed to find out when and where that first drop was. And I believe she said it was like 262 miles from here, so I should be able to easily make that with no problem tomorrow, Sunday. So that ought to work out. Now, last night, I don't know, I stopped at White Pine, Tennessee. It was fairly early, and I went inside, and I went into McDonald's in there, and I had one of their chicken salads. Came back out to the truck, and I don't know, I was really feeling tired, and so I just went to bed. and it was about, I guess I woke up... It was pushing about 9 a.m. this morning, Central Time, when I woke up, and so I kind of got around and then got headed toward Covington, Tennessee. Now, Covington is actually, it's near Memphis. It's about, I don't know, probably 35 miles north of Memphis on U.S. Highway 51. So it's kind of in the Memphis area, but it's sort of outside it a little bit. It's a nice day today. Temperature wise, the highest temperature I saw was around 70 degrees, and sun was out all day. Now, I drove through. Of course, I had that huge flood in Nashville, and I had to drive right through Nashville on Interstate 40, and I didn't really know what to expect. As far as what would it look like? Because a guy, when I was eating McDonald's last night, this guy was, I asked, this guy was, said he was from Nashville, and I asked him, well, did they have Interstate 40 closed? And he said, yeah, at one point they did have it closed, but, of course, all the water's gone now. That's, you know, it didn't take long, and then all the water's gone, and it left all the damage, and I guess there's a lot of damage. But as far as driving through Nashville on Interstate 40 today, it looked perfectly normal. So as far as driving through, at least on Interstate 40, now, several days after the fact, you can't. There's just nothing to indicate that anything out of the ordinary happened at all. But that's from Interstate 40, and you know, there's no puddles of water or no, you know, no mud on the road, or everything looked perfectly normal. Traffic on the freeway and so on and so forth. Now, I'm sure in other parts you may have to get off the freeway system in order to see the damage. I don't know. It may be a different story on Interstate 24, because I did watch that video. When I first saw that, I saw a news story about Nashville with the extensive flooding, and I watched that video where Interstate 24, where there was this, it looked like it was some sort of a built modular building that was just kind of going down the interstate, floating down the interstate, and it kind of got caught, and then it got the sort of the roof ripped off of it, and it kind of fell apart. And I was asking that guy about that, and he said, I was saying, well, how did that get on the interstate? And he said, well, the water was so high that it was like an annex building for a church. I forget what church he said, but it was an annex building for a church, and it simply floated off. The water carried it off, and the water was so high that it just was able to get over the, I guess there's a retaining wall for the freeway, and the water was well above that, and this thing just got floated right onto the freeway. But from what they're saying, there's really extensive damage in certain parts of Nashville, but again, I couldn't see it from Interstate 40. But Nashville, I don't know, Nashville's kind of a hilly place, and so it's got some low areas and it's got some higher areas. But from what I understand, well, like that Opryland, they were saying that Opryland Hotel is so damaged that they're estimating it won't reopen until December. And they're saying it's like a 1,000-year flood. It's not a 100-year flood or a 500-year flood. It's a 1,000-year flood, because it just rained and rained and rained for a couple of days. Just amazing amounts of rain. Didn't let up. And then so places that have never flooded before were suddenly threatened and engulfed in many cases. So I don't know. It's the water kind of went away, and I was trying to kind of pay attention. Some of the streams here and there, you know, as you're driving along Interstate 40, there's different bodies of water that you periodically go over, little creeks and rivers and what have you. And I was kind of trying to pay attention to those, and some of those looked like they were up high. You know, they were up pretty good. Now, I don't know. I don't think Memphis was affected at all. This was just more of a Nashville area, and maybe some other parts of Tennessee might have got it too. But Tennessee is a very long, you know, it's kind of a narrow, but it's a very long state. You know, it's like 400 and, well, if you know, from where you cross from Arkansas into over into Memphis on the western side, and then you go all the way across 40 and then up Interstate 71, you're probably, that's like 475 miles altogether across. So it's a very long state. Covers a wide area, but it's north and south wise. It's more of a narrow state. So, but Nashville got it. But again, I couldn't, you know, as driving through, I couldn't really see it. So, at least on Interstate 40. Got a new advertiser I want to talk about. This is kind of a unique advertiser. And I'll just go ahead and kind of tell you about it. The new advertiser is Your Baby Can Read. And I've looked at the website, and I'll go ahead and just kind of read through the ad copy here. So I'm just going to read this, and, you know, I'd rather just I could probably just tell you about it as well, but reading through this really wants, you know, it really describes sort of what this is. So I want to tell you about a remarkable new learning system I've discovered. It's called Your Baby Can Read, and it's changing the way families teach reading skills to their kids. It all started when Dr. Robert Titzer, a leading infant researcher, taught his own baby to read when she was just 9 months old. When he realized she was recognizing words at such an early stage, he knew he had to share this breakthrough with the world, so he created Your Baby Can Read. Your Baby Can Read works because it taps into children's natural ability to learn language in the first 5 years of life. Using videos, books, flashcards, and games, this truly revolutionary multi-sensory reading system has helped thousands of children as young as 3 months old to begin learning to read. And it can work for your child too, but don't just take my word for it. Go to yourbabycanread.com to see for yourself. You'll find some amazing home videos of infants and toddlers actually reading. Just go to yourbabycanread.com. That's yourbabycanread.com and you'll see a six-month-old baby recognizing words on flashcards, an 18-month-old who can actually read sentences, and a toddler reading Charlotte's Web to her parents. Best of all, you can even try the program yourself risk-free to find out what your child can do. Again, the website is yourbabycanread.com. Can you imagine a better gift to give to your child? And the talking points, Your Baby Can Read is truly revolutionary infant reading system. It was developed by a leading infant researcher, Dr. Robert Titzer, who taught his own daughter to read when she was just 9 months old. Your Baby Can Read taps into children's natural ability to learn language in the first 5 years of life. The reading system includes videos, books, flashcards, and games. Go to yourbabycanread.com to watch real home videos of infants and toddlers reading. A six-month-old recognizing words on flashcards, an 18-month-old reading sentences, a toddler reading Charlotte's Web. Try it yourself risk-free and see what your child can do. Visit yourbabycanread.com. Give the lifelong gift of early literacy to your child. Now, this actually makes sense, that a child would be able to do that. And it's particularly true if it taps into the child's natural curiosity about the world. Human beings are very unique creatures. You compare a human being to a chimpanzee or to a dolphin, or, you know, find the most intelligent animal and compare a human child to that animal. The human child, you know, we have to learn to be human. We really do. I really believe that. We have to, even as adults, we really do have to learn to be human beings. But we can learn. You know, we are just leaps and bounds above any animal, you know, as far as what we can learn to do and how adaptable we are. There's no comparison between human beings and our, you know, the, you know, you want to say, well, certain types of chimpanzees are the most intelligent animals. There really is, you know, we are just quantum leaps. There's no way of describing how much more flexible and advanced human beings are. And when you think about, you know, how does a child learn how to speak? How does that happen? You know, you don't go to school to learn how to speak. You know, your parents are there and the kids just kind of pick up the noises, whatever the language is. Each language is basically consists of a series of noises that it's like a code that means something, and somehow the kid's able to take all those parts and put it together. Well, it would really follow that they can do the same thing with words, different symbols, you know. So this is actually an interesting system, and they do have videos on the website that sort of demonstrate this. So this is really kind of remarkable, and I'm surprised someone hasn't found this sooner. And maybe they have, but it just, you know, weren't aware of it, basically. So, you know, if you got a toddler or a, you know, just a baby, check this out. You know, check the free trial out. And I'm going to have a link in the show notes for it as well. So yourbabycanread.com. So it's pretty interesting. So I have some more clips from Scott Mitchell, scottpodcast.com, that's the Uncommon Sense podcast, voice files. But first, my friend Ron Stroop, now I'm subscribed to TED Talks. It's a video podcast, TED Talks. A lot of these TED Talks, there's some of them that are just unbelievably interesting. There are some of them that are so-so, and then there's some of them that are just sort of boring. But what they do with the concept with TED, this TED Talks, what the concept is that it's, you know, they have these people at these TED gatherings. Excuse me. They have these people come to these TED gatherings. They invite them to come to speak. Different people. And they give them so many minutes. They have so many minutes, a limited number of minutes to make their presentation. And, you know, they tell them, you know, we want you to be as just thought-provoking as possible. Whatever, they don't want them promoting. They don't want them doing self-promoting. They can talk about their work, but they don't want them, you know, pushing books and stuff like that they've written. But, so, in the meantime, I've been subscribed to TED Talks, and of course, I'm using iTunes as my podcast aggregator. And the problem is, if you don't listen to a podcast or you don't watch a video podcast, after three podcasts come in and you haven't watched it or listened to it, then iTunes automatically assumes, you haven't watched this podcast, you haven't listened to it, I'm going to stop. And then to get it to go again, you've actually got to click on the little exclamation point and tell it to go ahead and resume updating the podcast. Well, that happened to my TED podcast that I'd subscribed to, the HD version of the TED Talks. That had happened, I don't know, a couple, 3 weeks ago, and I just kind of let it go. I kind of got behind, and I thought, well, I'll just not worry about it right now. Well, anyway, Ron called me up and he said, hey, you've got to check out this one of these, the newest TED Talks. The fellow's name is Simon Sinek, Sinek. And he's really, he wrote this book, you know, and now he's not talking about the book in the video. He's just basically talking about the principle that he sort of discovered. It's really quite remarkable. Just, you know, when you understand what he's saying, it's one of those things, you know, like, duh, you know, like, how come, you know, how come I couldn't think of that? But in any case, I'm going to go ahead and play this, and I may end up doing a stop-start on it. I don't know. It's about 18 minutes and 34 seconds. The fellow's name is Simon Sinek.
How do you explain when things don't go as we assume? Or better, how do you explain when others are able to achieve things that seem to defy all of the assumptions? For example, why is Apple so innovative? Year after year after year after year, they're more innovative than all their competition. And yet, they're just a computer company. They're just like everyone else. They have the same access to the same talent, the same agencies, the same consultants, the same media. Then why is it that they seem to have something different? Why is it that Martin Luther King led the civil rights movement? He wasn't the only man who suffered in a pre-civil rights America. And he certainly wasn't the only great orator of the day. Why him? And why is it that the Wright brothers were able to figure out controlled powered manned flight when there were certainly other teams who were better qualified, better funded, and they didn't achieve powered manned flight, and the Wright brothers beat them to it? There's something else at play here. About 3.5 years ago, I made a discovery, and this discovery profoundly changed my view on how I thought the world worked, and it even profoundly changed the way in which I operate in it. As it turns out, there's a pattern. As it turns out, all the great and inspiring leaders and organizations in the world, whether it's Apple or Martin Luther King or the Wright brothers, they all think, act, and communicate the exact same way, and it's the complete opposite to everyone else. All I did was codify it. And it's probably the world's simplest idea. I call it the golden circle. Why, how, what? This little idea explains why some organizations and some leaders are able to inspire where others aren't. Let me define the terms really quickly. Every single person, every single organization on the planet knows what they do, 100%. Some know how they do it, whether you call it your differentiating value proposition or your proprietary process or your USP. But very, very few people or organizations know why they do what they do. And by why, I don't mean to make a profit. That's a result. It's always a result. By why, I mean what's your purpose? What's your cause? What's your belief? Why does your organization exist? Why do you get out of bed in the morning? And why should anyone care? Well, as a result, the way we think, the way we act, the way we communicate is from the outside in. It's obvious. We go from the clearest thing to the fuzziest thing. But the inspired leaders and the inspired organizations, regardless of their size, regardless of their industry, all think, act, and communicate from the inside out. Let me give you an example. I use Apple because they're easy to understand and everybody gets it. If Apple were like everyone else, a marketing message from them might sound like this. We make great computers. They're beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. Want to buy one? Meh. And that's how most of us communicate. That's how most marketing is done. That's how most sales is done. And that's how most of us communicate interpersonally. We say what we do. We say how we're different or how we better. And we expect some sort of behavior, a purchase, a vote, something like that. Here's our new law firm. We have the best lawyers with the biggest clients. We have, you know, we always perform for our clients, do business with us. Here's our new car. It gets great gas mileage. It has, you know, leather seats. Buy our car. But it's uninspiring. Here's how Apple actually communicates. Everything we do, we believe in challenging the status quo. We believe in thinking differently. The way we challenge the status quo is by making our products beautifully designed, simple to use, and user-friendly. We just happen to make great computers. Want to buy one? totally different, right? You're ready to buy a computer from me. All I did was reverse the order of the information. What it proves to us is that people don't buy what you do, people buy why you do it. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. This explains why every single person in this room is perfectly comfortable buying a computer from Apple. But we're also perfectly comfortable buying an MP3 player from Apple, or a phone from Apple, or a DVR from Apple. But as I said before, Apple's just a computer company. There's nothing that distinguishes them structurally from any of their competitors. Their competitors are all equally qualified to make all of these products. In fact, they tried. A few years ago, Gateway came out with flat screen TVs. They're eminently qualified to make flat screen TVs. They've been making flat screen monitors for years. Nobody bought one. And Dell. Dell came out with MP3 players and PDAs. And they make great quality products, and they can make perfectly well-designed products, and nobody bought one. In fact, talking about it now, we can't even imagine buying an MP3 player from Dell. Why would you buy an MP3 player from a computer company? But we do it every day. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. The goal is not to do business with anybody, with everybody who needs what you have. The goal is to do business with people who believe what you believe. Here's the best part. None of what I'm telling you is my opinion. It's all grounded in the tenets of biology, not psychology, biology. If you look at a cross-section of the human brain looking from the top down, what you see is the human brain is actually broken into three major components that correlate perfectly with the golden circle. Our newest brain, our Homo sapien brain, our neocortex, corresponds with the what level. The neocortex is responsible for all of our rational and analytical thought and language. The middle two sections make up our limbic brains, and our limbic brains are responsible for all of our feelings, like trust and loyalty. It's also responsible for all human behavior, all decision-making, and it has no capacity for language. In other words, when we communicate from the outside in, yes, people can understand vast amounts of complicated information like features and benefits and facts and figures. It just doesn't drive behavior. When we communicate from the inside out, we're talking directly to the part of the brain that controls behavior, and then we allow people to rationalize it with the tangible things we say and do. This is where gut decisions come from. You know, sometimes you can give somebody all the facts and your figures, and they say, I know what all the facts and details say, but it just doesn't feel right. Why would we use that verb? It doesn't feel right. Because the part of the brain that controls decision-making doesn't control language. And the best we can muster up is, I don't know, it just doesn't feel right. Or sometimes you say you're leading with your heart or you're leading with your soul. Well, I hate to break it to you, those aren't other body parts controlling your behavior. It's all happening here in your limbic brain, the part of the brain that controls decision-making and not language. But if you don't know why you do what you do, and people respond to why you do what you do, then how will anybody... How will you ever get people to vote for you or buy something from you, or more importantly, be loyal and want to be a part of what it is that you do? Again, the goal is not just to sell people who need what you have. The goal is to sell to people who believe what you believe. The goal is not just to hire people who need a job. It's to hire people who believe what you believe. I always say that, you know, there's hire people just because they can do a job, they'll work for your money. But if you hire people who believe what you believe, they work for you with blood and sweat and tears. And nowhere else is there a better example of this than with the Wright brothers. Most people don't know about Samuel Pierpont Langley. And back in the early 20th century, the pursuit of powered man flight was like the dot-com of the day. Everybody was trying it. And Samuel Pierpont Langley had what we assume to be the recipe for success. I mean, even now, you ask people, why did your product or why did your company fail? And people always give you the same permutation of the same three things. Undercapitalized, the wrong people, bad market conditions. It's always the same three things. So let's explore that. Samuel Pierpont Langley was given $50,000 by the War Department to figure out this flying machine. Money was no problem. He held a seat at Harvard and worked at the Smithsonian and was extremely well-connected. He knew all the big minds of the day. He hired the best minds money could find, and the market conditions were fantastic. The New York Times followed him around everywhere, and everyone was rooting for Langley. And how come we've never heard of Samuel Pierpont Langley? A few hundred miles away in Dayton, Ohio, Orville and Wilbur Wright. They had none of what we consider to be the recipe for success. They had no money. They paid for their dream with the proceeds from their bicycle shop. Not a single person on the Wright brothers' team had a college education, not even Orville or Wilbur. And the New York Times followed them around nowhere. The difference was Orville and Wilbur were driven by a cause, by a purpose, by a belief. They believed that if they could figure out this flying machine, it'll change the course of the world. Samuel Pierpont Langley was different. He wanted to be rich, and he wanted to be famous. He was in pursuit of the result. He was in pursuit of the riches. And lo and behold, look what happened. The people who believed in the Wright brothers' dream worked with them with blood and sweat and tears. The others just worked for the paycheck. And they tell stories of how every time the Wright brothers went out, they would have to take 5 sets of parts because that's how many times they would crash before they came in for supper. And eventually, on December 17th, 1903, the Wright brothers took flight. And no one was there to even experience it. We found out about it a few days later. And further proof that Langley was motivated by the wrong thing, the day the Wright brothers took flight, he quit. He could have said, "That's an amazing discovery, guys, and I will improve upon your technology." But he didn't. He wasn't first, he didn't get rich, he didn't get famous, so he quit. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And if you talk about what you believe, you will attract those who believe what you believe. Well, why is it important to attract those who believe what you believe? Something called the law of diffusion of innovation. And if you don't know the law, you definitely know the terminology. The first 2.5% of our population are our innovators. The next 13.5% of our population are our early adopters. The next 34% are your early majority, your late majority, and your laggards. The only reason these people buy touch-tone phones is because you can't buy rotary phones anymore. We all sit at various places at various times on the scale, but what the law of diffusion of innovation tells us is that if you want mass market success or mass market acceptance of an idea, you cannot have it until you achieve this tipping point between 15 and 18% market penetration, and then the system tips. And I love asking businesses, what's your conversion on new business? And they love to tell you, oh, it's about 10%, proudly. Well, you can trip over 10% of the customers. We all have about 10% who just get it. That's how we describe them, right? That's like that gut feeling, oh, they just get it. The problem is, how do you find the ones that just get it before you're doing business with them versus the ones who don't get it? So it's this here, this little gap, that you have to close, as Jeffrey Moore calls it, crossing the chasm. Because you see, the early majority will not try something until someone else has tried it first. And these guys, the innovators and the early adopters, they're comfortable making those gut decisions. They're more comfortable making those intuitive decisions that are driven by what they believe about the world and not just what product is available. These are the people who stood online for 6 hours to buy an iPhone when they first came out, when you could have just walked into the store the next week and bought one off the shelf. These are the people who spent $40,000 on flat screen TVs when they first came out, even though the technology was substandard. And by the way, they didn't do it because the technology was so great. They did it for themselves. It's because they wanted to be first. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And what you do simply proves what you believe. In fact, people will do the things that prove what they believe. The reason that person bought the iPhone in line for six hours, was because of what they believed about the world and how they wanted everybody to see them. They were first. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. So let me give you a famous example, a famous failure and a famous success of the law of diffusion of innovation. First, the famous failure. It's a commercial example. As we said before a second ago, the recipe for success is money and the right people and the right market conditions, right? You should have success then. Look at TiVo. From the time TiVo came out about 8 or 9 years ago to this current day, they are the single highest quality product on the market. Hands down, there is no dispute. They were extremely well-funded. Market conditions were fantastic. I mean, we use TiVo as a verb. I TiVo stuff on my piece of junk Time Warner DVR all the time. But TiVo is a commercial failure. They've never made money. And when they went IPO, their stock was at about $30 or $40 and then plummeted, and it's never traded above 10. In fact, I don't think it's even traded above 6, except for a couple of little spikes. Because you see, when TiVo launched their product, they told us all what they had. They said, we have a product that pauses live TV, skips commercials, rewinds live TV, and memorizes your viewing habits without you even asking. And the cynical majority said, we don't believe you. We don't need it. We don't like it. You're scaring us. What if they had said, if you're the kind of person who likes to have total control over every aspect of your life, boy, do we have a product for you. It pauses live TV, skips commercials, memorizes your viewing habits, etc., etc. People don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it, and what you do simply serves as the proof of what you believe. Now let me give you a successful example of the law of diffusion of innovation. In the summer of 1963, 250,000 people showed up on the Mall in Washington to hear Dr. King speak. They sent out no invitations, and there was no website to check the date. How do you do that? Well, Dr. King wasn't the only man in America who was a great orator. He wasn't the only man in America who suffered in a pre-civil rights America. In fact, some of his ideas were bad. But he had a gift. He didn't go around telling people what needed to change in America. He went around and told people what he believed. I believe, I believe, I believe, he told people. And people who believed what he believed took his cause and they made it their own, and they told people. And some of those people created structures to get the word out to even more people. And lo and behold, 250,000 people showed up on the right day, on the right time, to hear him speak. How many of them showed up for him? Zero. They showed up for themselves. It's what they believed about America that got them to travel on a bus for 8 hours to stand in the sun in Washington in the middle of August. It's what they believed. And it wasn't about black versus white. 25% of the audience was white. Dr. King believed that there are two types of laws in this world, those that are made by a higher authority and those that are made by man. And not until all the laws that are made by man are consistent with the laws that are made by the higher authority will we live in a just world. It just so happens that the civil rights movement was the perfect thing to help him bring his cause to life. We followed him not for him, but for ourselves. And by the way, he gave the I have a dream speech, not the I have a plan speech. Listen to politicians now with their comprehensive 12-point plans. They're not inspiring anybody. Because there are leaders and there are those who lead. Leaders hold a position of power or authority, but those who lead inspire us. Whether they're individuals or organizations, we follow those who lead, not because we have to, but because we want to. We follow those who lead, not for them, but for ourselves. And it's those who start with why that have the ability to inspire those around them or find others who inspire them. Thank you very much.
Okay, so there was the TED Talk. The fellow's name is Simon Sinek. And he's actually, I looked him up in Google. And he's actually got a website. He's written a book that is, the name of it is Start With Why. That's the name of his book, Start With Why. And, you know, really fascinating. You know, this, you know, I mean, it. You listen to what he says and it makes perfect sense. It really does make perfect sense. You know, start with why. Why, you know, tell people what you believe. And you end up with, you know, I've said basically a lot of this stuff, you know, in regards to podcasting. You know, as far as motivation to podcast, you know, if, you know, the the way I podcast, the type of podcasting I do, I kind of, you know, you kind of end up with listeners that believe the same way. You know, and I tell you right up front, you know, that I tend to be conservative, and, you know, I'm telling you what I believe all the time, as far as, you know, what I believe. And, you know, and that works, certainly it works with podcasting, but it works with everything. You know, and the examples he gave are really good. You know, Apple is one that I think, you know, it's like he says, everybody gets that one. They really understand it. But this is just, it's really basic stuff. But we don't, it's one of those things we kind of don't think about. You know, because he's basically saying you simply revert. You have to understand why you do what you do, and if you know, and then that gets into the other thing. You know, and podcasting is a great example because there's a lot of people that kind of come and go in podcasting, and there's been some people that have just kind of stuck around, you know, the entire time. Or they start doing it and they do stick around if they've got the right motive, but the right motive is tricky. You know, when it comes to podcasting or anything else, if you have the wrong motive, then you probably won't stick with it very long. There's been a lot of people that thought, well, I want a podcast, but then, you know, maybe they're thinking, oh, I can make money on it, or, you know, and they may podcast for a little bit, and then they find out, ooh, this is work, and they lose interest, and they move on. My motivation to podcast has always been primarily to make friends. By the way, when I stopped at, what is it, exit 127 this afternoon before I came on over to Covington, Tennessee, stopped at exit 127, there's something 40 truck stop, back 40 or something. There's a truck stop that's been there for years. So I stopped there to get something. It was late this afternoon. I stopped there to get something to eat before I went on over to Covington. And so I was parking my truck, and here comes this driver. And, you know, so it turns out it was a podcast listener, Paul Turner, PT Gizmo on Twitter. Twittered back and forth with him a couple of times. You know, and he spotted me. Of course, I'm easy to spot. And he wanted to say hi, and so I got to chit-chat with him a little bit. You know, and but the, you know, the point of this, this, you know, what this guy, what this Simon Sinek is saying really rings true, that if you tell people what you believe, you know, then, you know, if you start with what you believe, then you're going to at least end up with people that kind of believe the same way. And as I say, that's certainly true in the world of podcasting. You know, but if you, there, if you, you know, you start out, well, I want so many listeners, and I want to maybe make money on it, and I want to do this, and I want to do that, and you kind of get it backwards, you know, the way that most people end up approaching things, then chances are that you're not going to, you know, you don't have the right motivation, and you know, it may not go anywhere. So, you know, and then in regards to business, you know, people that are motivated, they're passionate. Obviously, somebody like Steve Jobs is passionate about making computers a certain way, or, you know, different types of electronic devices besides computers today, you know, like iPads and so on and so forth. By the way, had two different people today tell me, hey, I bought an Apple product. Ian sent me an email. Ian from Ottawa, Canada, he sent me an email earlier today. I just discovered it, saying, hey, I drove to Syracuse and I was able to buy a 16 gigabyte iPad. And so then Ron Stroop called me this evening, and he bought a Mac Mini at Best Buy. So Apple is selling products. But they start out with what they believe. And I think that's important, because Apple, to begin with, Apple really did start out with what they believed. And they ended up surrounding themselves with a lot of customers that believed the same way, as far as how, you know, how a computer should work. And you know, that, of course, after Steve Jobs, you know, Steve Jobs came back, and then then particularly since they moved to the Intel platform a few years ago, that really kind of changed things, and it's really attracted a lot of people to Apple computers. And then, of course, the iPhone, and then the iPod Touch, and the now the iPad. They've really come out with some remarkable pieces of technology. And but it's really, the attraction really is based on belief. And believing that we can, you know, they're believing that, you know, they can come up with different pieces of technology that really work well and solve certain problems. And, you know, and they've been able to create new categories of devices. And, you know, so Apple's a great example of this principle. You know, start out with why. Why are you in business doing whatever it is? You know, and then, you know, your product or service after the fact serves as the proof. But you know, so that's really an interesting thing to remember. You know, why are you doing what you do? You know, why do you exist? Why do I exist? And of course, you know, it's not an easy thing to know sometimes. I think a lot of, you know, there may be people in different types of businesses that really are, they don't really know why they do what they do. And, you know, but I thought that was, that's really, this guy's really hit upon something really fundamental. You know, if you can surround yourself with people that believe the same way, then that really makes a profound difference. You know, if you're actually going to sell them something, whether it's, you know, sell them on an idea, sell them on a, you know, just different concepts, or actually sell them a product. You know, it all kind of follows. It really does follow the same pattern. So. But that's a very interesting talk. So anyway, I've also got, we got a few minutes left. I've got some more files that, voice files, or they're really podcast response files that Scott Mitchell sent me. And I haven't previewed any of these. So let's go ahead and listen to this first one, and that'll probably take us out to the end of the podcast, but this first one is about 6 minutes and 58 seconds, so here is Scott.
Okay, Tom, you're reading this note by one of your listeners, the one who kind of flew off the handle and was using four-letter words, the F-bomb, and talking about that, and along the lines of the conversation, he said, imagine what it would be like to be a kid who was born out of wedlock and doesn't know who his mother or father is. Imagine how horrible that must be. I'm not saying that there isn't going to be a curiosity by all children who are adopted or otherwise estranged from their biological parent about what their biological parents were, where they came from, and stuff like that. But I got to point something out, that there's a lot of head trip involved in that, Tom. And if you buy into it too much yourself, Tom, you won't make it any easier for these kids, even adults for that fact, to get over this head trip, because it is a lot of head trip. What I mean is just thinking, oh, I'll never get to know my mother or father. They're not really your mother and father. I think what we need to define is terms here, Tom. What do you think the definition of mother or father is?
Well, let me interrupt. Now, maybe I didn't express myself very well, but what I had in mind was, you know, not some kid that's an orphan that doesn't, you know, or maybe he's been put in an orphanage or he's been adopted, because that kid has a mother and father, you know, whoever adopts him, if it's, you know, usually it's going to be at least traditionally it's been a family that adopts him or her, they have a mother and father. So that's, you know, their adoptive parents. They've got someone actually there fulfilling those roles. What I really had in mind are these, you know, there's a large percentage of, you know, over 50% of kids are being born outside of wedlock at this point. Okay? A large percentage, I'm not sure what that percentage is, but a large percentage of those kids have no dad, no male figure fulfilling the role of dad in their lives. I've told this story before. One time, this has been years ago, way back in the 80s, I had unloaded, I don't know, it was like some warehouse or something. You know, I'd pulled up there, I don't remember. I think I'd just gotten there. This would have been late 80s. And there was this kid standing out there, you know, kind of watching me pull up in the truck, you know, because this warehouse was kind of right next to a, it was right next door to a sort of an older residential area. And so here was this kid, you know, and I'm assuming he was probably like maybe 7, 8, 9 years old. And, you know, he was just really watching me, you know, and so he was just kind of standing there, and I don't remember, you know, exactly how the conversation went, but I asked him, do you want to look in my truck? And he was all excited, you know, looking in the truck. And so I chit-chatted with him a little bit, and I don't remember the details of the conversation, but I asked him what his dad did for a living. And what he said just ripped my heart out. He said, I don't have a dad. Oh, you know. So it's that type of kid that, you know, they've got mom, you know, they were just a byproduct of sex. They always have some woman raising them, invariably. Very, very rarely is dad raising the kid, you know, unless he's a widow or something. Very, very seldom is a man, you know, is the dad actually going to be raising the kid. It's always mom. And so the ones that I had in mind were the ones that they're born outside of marriage and there is no dad. Either mom doesn't know who the dad was or dad was, you know, simply a sperm donor. And that kind of situation is heinous. It's just detestable. You know, so I'm not really talking about, you know, people that have been adopted. I'm talking about a kid that has no dad, doesn't know who the dad is, or the dad's just, you know, went off on his merry way because he was irresponsible. And, you know, so that's really what I had in mind. And that is unconscionable.
Because I got a feeling they're different than mine. Now, granted, somebody born out of wedlock isn't going to know who, what I, my my term would be this, biological mother and father, or to put it more bluntly, egg donor and sperm donor. That's all they really are, is the egg donor and sperm donor. because it takes oh so much more to be a mother and father. And I know of what I speak, because, as you know, I talk about my grandkids. My grandkids are not biologically related to me, but I am, in every sense that truly counts, their grandfather. I'm doing the job. And Judy, I don't think anybody would deny the fact that she's their grandmother, and that her daughter, who bore these children, is in fact her daughter. Because there's where the disconnect is, you see. Her daughter was adopted, Korean. Doesn't know her mother or father. Nor does her son, who was also adopted. And by the way, he was born of different mother and father than, you know, Judy's daughter was.
Okay, let me interrupt again. That's a different type of situation, and a kid, you know, kids that have been adopted, usually, you know, there's some different, you know, that, like you described it as a head trip, that is a little bit different. That's a different situation. I'm talking about the ones that just are just out there having sex, and then mom ends up on welfare, dad flies the coop, or she doesn't even know who it is, and there is no one fulfilling the role. 'Cause obviously anybody, you know, the situation you're describing, you're fulfilling the role of grandfather. That's a completely different story. I'm talking about the ones that there's nobody there fulfilling the dad role.
In both cases, they were adopted Korean children of totally different parents. They would never, ever get to know who their parents are. It, in fact, was unknown. They were abandoned. And now that can be a horrible feeling, and I know that her son, he fought the demons in his mind about that for a while. He got over it. And I think she did too, but just in a different way. There is this head trip that goes on of not knowing who your real parents were or why they got rid of you, why weren't you worth them keeping. There is that head trip. And human beings have a way of going on these trips. It's better if your parents can have a way of letting you see what these people really are. They're an egg and a sperm donor. And they're really of no more significance than, if you're into genealogy, you can go and look back and find out what your grandfather and your great-grandfather and your great-great-great-grandfather and cousins and uncles. You can get a very complex family tree. And at the end of the day, what does it really tell you about you? Are you your family tree? I don't tend to believe that's the case.
Well, generally speaking, I don't either. You know, because my belief, and I've expressed this over and over again, and it's absolutely worth expressing once again. I believe that human beings, we as human beings, are three parts. We're mind, spirit, and body. Obviously, the body part comes from our genealogy, our physical genealogy. And so you have an egg and a sperm, and you've got chromosomes, and those chromosomes, when that egg and sperm unite, those chromosomes come together, and you end up with a unique individual from a physical standpoint. And that, I think that probably does end up kind of controlling many of our abilities, at least from a biological standpoint, you know. And then you have, you know, there's the mental aspect of that. That probably a lot of that comes from our environment. And then there's this mysterious spiritual aspect. And I believe that, it's my belief that that spiritual part, you know, and again, it's a mystery, but that spiritual part can enable us to overcome physical challenges, you know, or as far as, you know, our genetics to a certain extent, and the, you know, and to a certain extent, you know, the kind of the mental environment that we're raised in. But we, you know, there have been studies done, and I remember reading the articles here in the podcast some time back. It's been probably a couple of years ago. But there was this one study that was done where they found that beliefs, people's attitudes, could actually affect their genetics. You know, which genes get turned on and which genes get turned off. And so therefore, your beliefs can actually, and your attitude can actually have a profound effect on whether you, you know, let's say you're genetically predisposed to get some illness of some sort. Well, your beliefs can actually end up controlling whether you get that or not. You know, and conversely, you know, you can look at that and you can say, well, if that's the case with genetic predisposition to diseases and attitudes affecting that, either positively or negatively, then you could also say, well, you know, my attitude could probably overcome other types of things, you know, as well. So, you know, attitude, you know, there's this whole saying, attitude is altitude. Attitude is really everything. You know, when it, if you get the right attitude, I really believe that it can help you overcome, you know, not only your genetics, but the mental environment in which you were raised. But, you know, that spiritual part is really the inclination, as I've talked about many times, the inclination, you know, of basically whether you accept, you know, you're willing, you want the identity that comes from God, something that we can't see. You want that, it's kind of a latent identity. You have to really want it. And the want to is really something mysterious. Why do some people want that identity and nothing else will do? And then other people are simply happy, you know, kind of living in, you know, whatever they're presented with. They may grumble about it, but they, you know, they're just kind of happy with being kind of shaped by their environment, sort of, you know, shaped in a pressure cooker of an environment and whatever, you know, kind of mixed with the whatever they were given physically, you know, from a genetic standpoint. So, in any case, let's go ahead and listen to the rest of Scott's comment.
I think you're beyond, you can rise above your family tree. I don't think you are your family tree. Yeah, it makes for a great curiosity item. And there is something to the fact that your biology has some effect on you as far as how intelligent you're likely to be, how fat or thin, color, hair, things like this. Your physical characteristics, and a large extent, can be determined that way. But that'll be abundantly obvious to you. You know, if you've got certain characteristics, there's a good chance your mother and father had that. So, question answered, at least in any way that really matters. Now, I really don't think that it's important that they know everything there is to know about the egg donor or sperm donor that created them. I think it's by far the more important that they have a real mother and father in their life who does the job that a mother and father does, or in my case, a grandfather and grandmother, and in my case, in Judy's, because neither of us are biologically related to our grandkids. But you know what? I don't think most people, at least most civilized people, would sit there and say, you're not their grandparents. No, the people who they're, you know, and you're not their parents either. It's the egg and sperm donor. They own them. And the unfortunate thing in our society is that we do still have laws that give the lion's share of the rights to the people who are the egg and sperm donors, which I'm not even sure is right sometimes. Once the child, you know, you hear these extreme cases where the child has been raised by someone else, and then one day the parent steps in and is able to wrest control of that child from the people who have been the true parent to that child. I'm sure you've heard of these cases or read about them. I find them gut-wrenching and wrong that a parent would do that. If they weren't a parent enough to keep the child to begin with and do the job of mother or father, then they gave up that right, in my opinion. You become a mother and father by doing the job. And if you give it up for too long, then you cannot be mother and father beyond that. And in fact, you are not mother and father. You're just the egg or sperm donor. So that's my definition. And that's all I wanted to get in here, was kind of defining the terms. And maybe you agree and maybe you disagree, but it's something that I do feel pretty strongly about myself, that mother and father is a term that's defined by what job you do, not whether or not you're the biological parent.
Okay, well, thank you, Scott. Again, Scott's website and his podcast are located at scottpodcast.com. And I think we're basically in agreement. If someone is adopted, again, you know, if a kid is adopted and they've got a mom, you know, somebody doing the mom job and somebody doing the dad job, they've got a mom and a dad. And that's not the same thing as a sperm donor. You know, absolutely not. But the problem, you know, if there's no dad present, and that's basically what happens in a single-parent household. If there's no dad present, you know, for whatever reason, especially, and it's especially the case if mom doesn't even know who the dad was. She just got, you know, having sex with whoever and ended up getting pregnant and, you know, has the kid, and then you don't even know who the dad is, and there's no dad, there's nobody there to sort of fulfill the dad role. That creates all kinds of problems psychologically. You know, now it can be overcome. There are people that overcome it. Because when we come into this world, we end up hating our parents. Doesn't matter whether the parents are wonderful. The parents can be great parents. They can be perfect parents, you know, which is very rare. They can be wonderful parents, or that, you know, more likely the parents have shortcomings. And, you know, but, you know, even in a normal, quote unquote, normal nuclear family, we always end up hating our parents. Little kids tend to look at their parents as gods, and those gods sorely disappoint them. And so the key, you have to realize that, you know, you're hating your parents. And, you know, to get over that, you've got to realize that you resent your parents, because resentment is hatred. You resent your parents because they failed you. And you've got to get over it, because you've got to realize that those parents were, they resented their parents. And their parent, you know, and all the way back to, you know, to the, you know, if you want to believe the Adam and Eve story or not, there had to be a first pair of human beings. So, and of course, if you once you resent, you become a slave. Once you resent, you become suggestible. Once you resent, you're separated from who you could have been. And you become that which you hate. You know, that which you resent becomes your God. And you become enslaved to that. And so your parents that failed you, your mom and your dad that failed you, it's helpful to understand that they tried to do the best they could, and chances are, in most cases, they probably did try to do the best that they could, but they ended up failing you because their parents failed them. They didn't, they couldn't overcome it, even if, you could say, well, even if they're, if you have a deliberately mean parent, a bully parent, one of your parents is a bully and the other is kind of a wimp, which is very typical. They can't stop themselves. And you approach someone that doesn't know who their dad is, and you tell them this story, and you tell them, you resent your parents. And they'll say, well, I can't resent, I can't resent my dad because I didn't know who he was. I didn't have one. Well, you resented the fact that you didn't have one, and then you resent God because, by implication, you're resenting God because, here you are brought kind of brought into the world with no dad. That's not fair. And then you resent God. And by the way, resenting your dad is tantamount to resenting God. It's kind of, resenting God by extension. So it is possible for someone to, that's raised in that kind of a situation. Obviously, then they hate their mom too, because, they hate God, and then they hate their mom because mom was just a, just going around having sex with whoever and didn't even know who the dad was. Or maybe dad was irresponsible and fled the scene. So it is entirely possible to, if you can drop the resentment, that's really the key to everything. If you can drop the resentment to your parent, towards your parents, and you may not even be aware of it. You think, oh, I love my mom, or I love my dad. But they're still in control of you. Well, how can they still be in control if you don't resent them? Because the evidence that you resent them is the fact that they have control over you. Just the idea of them, that parent, they've got control over you. And, so that really is the key. Whether you've had someone fulfilling that the mom and the dad role or not, that really is the key to, kind of, if you can drop that resentment, then that's really the key to begin to sort of remove the barrier that, the wedge that separates you from who you could be. That latent identity that I talk about. And but statistically, somebody that doesn't have a dad, that doesn't have anybody fulfilling that dad role, statistically, they have a whole lot harder time, at a lot, every aspect of their life ends up being colored by that negatively. And but it is possible, if you can give up the resentment, for that part to be, once you're an adult, in particular, once you become an adult, if you just can give up that resentment, the resentment towards your dad not being there, resentment towards God for putting you in that situation, or resentment towards your mom for, making the wrong choice, then you can begin to actually move beyond that. And you just realize that, in that particular situation, that mom really probably didn't know any better. Mom was under her own compulsions, and so on and so forth. Made the wrong choice, and then there you are. But we've all, every single one of us, ended up resenting our parents. And we end up becoming our parents. You know, you know, once you resent, you've got two wrong choices. Either go along to get along, you become what you hate, or you try to rebel and do the opposite, and but you're still separated from who you could have been, who you would have been otherwise. But overall, it's much better if there's somebody there to fulfill that dad role, you know, somebody that's present. And it's very important. So, but I think it's just it's a modern day, it really is a modern day tragedy. And the kids today that are being born outside of marriage, over 50% here in the United States, and I suspect it's that way in a lot of other Western countries, over 50% being born into that situation, a good chunk of some of those people can survive, some of those people will overcome, but a good chunk of those will end up being just super suggestible. And I can only imagine, you know, they'll end up being fodder for a dictatorship, for some sort of future dictatorship. They're going to be enslaved to something, you know. So anyway, probably better be cutting this off. We're at 76 minutes. Hope everyone is having a great weekend, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.